Good morning and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, June 30th, 1999. In the fireside room this morning is our presenter, Wes Howard Brook. And today's session number is 99-8. And it is titled, Come Out of Her, My People. And it's John's portrait of Babylon. Let's listen to Wes Howard Brook.
For the end times and how and why that appeals to people. And then we looked at some of the other things in our culture that substitute for revelation among people for whom the Bible is no longer a source of wisdom. We then spent a couple of days looking at some tools which will come up today, and so if you weren't here last week or haven't been here this week, you might feel a little bit behind, but hopefully working together in a small group that'll pick up together. One of the things we looked at, and some of those things, some of the handouts at least are here so you can get some tools that might be helpful to you later. We looked at some of the Hebrew scripture background of both the roots of apocalyptic and how Revelation brings forward echoes of Hebrew scripture throughout the whole text. And I just had one handout that gives you an example of that, taking Revelation 4 and showing how every image is an echo of Hebrew scripture. So if you're interested, you can take that. We looked at the world of Roman Asia, out of which this text was written, and so we read it not as a universal document written to nobody in particular, but written to people living in these particular cities in the Roman province of Asia in the late first century, and what their world was like in terms of the Roman Empire's reality around them, the worship of emperor as imperial cult, and other aspects of life in these crowded, congested, dangerous cities that they were in. This week we began looking at Revelation. We looked on Monday at the very briefly at the structure of the whole book, and as this chart, as I know, is called a structure, not the structure, just a way of schematizing the whole book so you can get a sense of how the pieces fit together. And on Monday we focused on the heavenly liturgy scenes in contrast with the earthly liturgy in Revelation 13. And we looked at how these various scenes, seven of them, are a call to worship God as king, as emperor, if you will, in contrast with Caesar and participation in the culture and commerce of the empire of John's time, which of course was the Roman Empire. Yesterday we looked at the plot of the story of the book of Revelation as it's found in the sequence of seven seals, seven trumpets, seven bowls, and how it's a summary first of the failed efforts of God to get God's people to repent with threats of violence and plagues, and how the inside of Revelation is that the innovation of Jesus, if you will, his death and resurrection, inaugurates the end times, which are a time not of threats of punishment, but a time of nonviolent witness. A witness to evil about God that's willing to accept death, trusting that resurrection awaits. And calls followers to live that way. So that was the plot and a very quick nutshell of where we've been. I think we can start the tape now for today. Today in session 8, I'm going to invite you to work together a little bit, and then we'll gather the fruits of your work together collectively to ask the question about Revelation 18, the portrait of Babylon. What is Babylon's sin? And I'd like to just give you a couple minutes of background to prepare you for that. I'll give you a handout, too, in a moment that has both the text of Revelation, it's just the new RSV, so if you have that with you or any text, it doesn't really matter. I'd give you this one because it's got a few notes that explain a few images that you might not have time to get to now, but just for your future reference. This will be set out in great detail in our book, Unveiling Empire, Reading Revelation Then and Now, which will be out September 17th, and taking advance purchase requests here, so if you're interested, those are there. This handout also has on the back some quotes from the major prophets, one from Isaiah, one from Ezekiel, one from Jeremiah, that are echoed in Revelation 18, so that a biblically literate audience would say, what John's vision is telling him now isn't something new. It's just taking the wisdom of our ancestors and applying it to the current situation we're part of. Helping them see that their situation is part of the same struggle that their ancestors struggled with, of how to be God's people in an imperial environment. in the midst of an environment that worships some human-made system as if it was God-given, and organizes its political and economic system around that kind of belief. So I'll have you look at that and use that together to answer this question. But just a little bit of background for those who weren't here last week that'll help us perhaps address this. We're looking at a several-layer metaphor. We're looking at empire, specifically the Roman Empire, but more broadly, generically, empire, through the twin image of a whore and of this ancient city Babylon. And I use the, you know, kind of crass term whore rather than perhaps more polite term prostitute, because part of what John's trying to do here is not to be crass, but to be sharp, you know, to get people to wake up, to use the strongest language he possibly can to help his audience understand the consequences of the actions that they're living, and to make what he thinks are the choices that God wants them to make because of the vision he's been given. So, you know, I hope we'll see it. The language is very powerful, and if to the extent we try and soften it, we're doing it a disservice in its attempt to shake us up. Not to shock us in a prurient sense, but to just wake us up from kind of accepting life as it is and just kind of cruising down the road to hell, so to speak. Okay. Part of what it's also doing, and that's what these passages from the prophets I give you, which I don't expect you to read now. If we had 3 hours, we could spend a lot of time with it. But since we have one, I'll give it to you, and you can use it on your own if you like. Is to root this in the biblical story of cities, all the way from the beginning. I know a couple of you were actually here last week when we looked at this very briefly. So I just want to summarize that for most of you who weren't. The Hebrew word for city is ir. And I just want to invite us to trace that very briefly back. What's the first city in the Bible?
Anybody know?
Garden.
Well, Garden of Eden isn't a city.
Oh.
It's a garden.
Ur.
Okay, well, Ur, sometimes translated Ur, is the Hebrew word with capital made into a proper noun. See, it just means city. But there's a very specific city that's named as the first city. I know you know, Randall. You've been here before. Anybody know? If nobody else knows, go ahead, Randall.
It's Babel?
No. See, yeah, I thought you knew. It's not Babel. No, before Babel. All the way back to Genesis 4. It's really important to focus on this for a bit so we can see what the lineage is we're dealing with. Yeah, feel free to open up. This is an open book test.
Yeah.
What's the first city? And I'll just put up whatever you say for a while, and we'll see what we can come up with. And so feel free to, whatever came up in your group or in your own thoughts, this is my name, as simple as we can. What is Babylon Sin? Anyway.
They trusted in themselves rather than God. They
trusted in themselves. Okay, just keep going.
They thought their goods would just get them through everything.
They thought that the what would?
Their money and their goods.
Okay, money and goods. So they trusted not only in themselves but in their stuff, if you will, huh? Their money, their goods. Okay, good.
Separation of the Creator from the creation.
Okay. Separation of Creator from creation. Now, these are good. We're still a little abstract. You know, to separate, say, the Creator separated from the creation is true here. What do you do about it in daily life? That's sort of like saying greed. You know, it's true enough, but the text is so concrete that I'd like us to focus on it's, you know, on how specific it is. We tend to want to generalize.
Their priorities were all the valuable things they had to sell and buy.
Okay, so there's an emphasis on valuable things.
Materialism.
I'll write that down, but that's, yeah, we're being pretty general here. See, we tend to want to take the specifics of the text and generalize it, but what are the specifics of the text? It's specific for a reason.
Place of demons.
Place of demons. What does that mean? What do you think that means? What does it mean for a place to be full of demons?
You're violent.
Violence?
Godless.
What was that?
Godless.
Godless? Well, they're not godless. It's a different gods. You know, Bible's point of view is all the way through, there's no godless place. It's just a matter of which god you worship or gods. Atheism is a modern concept, you know.
They're valuable things. This list of stuff that the merchants were selling had important things like linen, which one of our ladies is a weaver, and she told us it's the first weaving that was done. That made it really valuable. And, oh, by the way, it also included people.
Included people. So the valuable things included people. Okay.
All nations were deceived by your sorcery.
There's deception. Sorcery, what do you think that means?
Magic.
Now again, this is apocalyptic imagery coming out of a biblical tradition and beyond. So in the same way that fornication here isn't about, you know, sexuality between two people, sorcery in a similar way is not about saying magic spells. The nations are deceived by her sorcery.
Sorcery is illicit power.
Okay. There's something here about illicit power. Yeah, Randall, you had your hand up?
Well, I took a few notes for my group. I won't say all of them, but one was fornication as an important part of a relationship was not being fulfilled. So something important in relationship was not being fulfilled. As an expression of fornication. Another person had the image of the Titanic in the sense of the quiet in the city. People, Babylon had thought it was invulnerable, apparently.
Okay, so connected with this trust in themselves in the sense of
self-sufficient, yeah, and the same with the queen saying in verse 7, I'm by myself, I don't really need anybody else.
Okay.
They would have had to have had a lot of slaves.
Okay, so valuable things, people, slaves, names specifically. Now, let's focus for a minute, if you will. I don't want to cut anybody off, so if you've got other things you want to say, feel free. But right at the center of the chapter is this rather remarkably specific list of stuff. Yeah. You wonder about that? After a while, you have to take a breath. You can't even read the thing in one breath. Gold, silver, you know, jewels, linen, bronze. Scented wood, cinnamon, incense, cattle, choice wheat, etc. What about that list? What holds that whole list together? Why is it there?
It says that the merchants, no one will buy their cargo anymore, and it just lists what the cargo was.
Okay, so it's, first of all, it's a list of cargo. That's important.
Now,
I'm going to get to this in a minute, but since you brought it up, we might as well just kind of do these at the same time. That there are three specific groups of martyrs. Mm-hmm. Let's name who those are. This will help us here.
The sailors
are connected with one group. Sailors,
merchants.
Well, okay, merchants is one group. There are three sets. Merchants is one set. Sailors is part of a trinity that's itself one set.
Seafarers and shipmasters.
Okay, shipmasters and seafarers. And what's the other group?
The kings of the earth.
Okay, kings of the earth. And again, as we looked at on Monday in terms of liturgy, in the same way that heaven is contrasted with earth in the liturgical sense as not a matter of afterlife or in the sky versus this planet and this lifetime, but that heaven in Revelation, as in any apocalyptic literature, is where God lives. Which means, in the literal sense of apocalyptic, on the other side of the veil, for those who haven't been here that much, apocalyptic, the word means to lift the veil. So apocalyptic is the other side of the veil. And that's where heaven is. Similarly, kings of the earth doesn't just mean, in the parallel term in Revelation, inhabitants of the earth. to use frequently, doesn't mean everybody on the planet, which of course would include everybody. It's separating the holy ones who live in heaven, doesn't mean they're dead, from the kings of the earth, those who have power in this realm, on this side of the veil, if you will. Okay? So the kings of the earth, the merchants, the sailors, shipmasters, and seafarers are those who mourn. These all related to this cargo, which is key to the business here. So what is it about that cargo?
Well, they're wants, not needs.
They're what?
They're wants, not needs.
Not exclusively, though, Karen. I mean, there's flour,
yeah,
cattle.
Yeah, it's fine flour.
Okay, it is fine flour. It emphasizes that. At some level, it's wants, not needs. Yeah?
The next verse, 14, says, the fruit for which your soul longed.
Okay. And in some translations, the dainties, you know, the glitter and glamour, all the goodies, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's all stuff that came from outside of Babylon.
Okay. They're imports. Key to this is, it's cargo. They're all imports.
They're taking sort of from the countryside.
There's no sort of about it. That's systematically, that's what empire does. Systematically takes stuff from people elsewhere and brings it to wherever the center of empire is. You know, that's what makes an empire. Here, empire under the image of great city and the whore Babylon has this list of cargo that begins with all kinds of lovely stuff, gold and silver, and ends with people under two images, slaves and human lives. Now, grammatically, in Greek, that can be read one of two ways. It could be slaves, by which I mean human lives, you know, or in other words, slaves, that is, human lives, so that they're talking about one reality. It can also, it's ambiguous, it can also be read slaves, meaning people who are bought and sold, literally, and among the cargo list are human lives of people who aren't bought and sold in the literal sense, but are anyway. People whom empire buys and sells through its seductive power. Okay, so those who don't appear to be slaves, but in fact are anyway. You know, their soul longs for all this stuff, and they're slaves to it. Slaves to this artificial desire through which Babylon's sorcery has led them to believe that confuse their needs and their wants. To long for things that, you know, that they don't need, almost by definition, for the fact that they're from elsewhere. The people live forever without those things. Empire has put it in their lap, so to speak, and now they long for it. They're enslaved to it. Okay. So, looking at some of this together, now what else might we say about the sin? What's at the center? Some of this is all true, but kind of general. If you were a Christian, trying to be a Christian in these little cities, handful of, or not little cities, but little communities within these cities, handful of Christians, you know, in Ephesus or one of these places, Pergamum, might not be any more than are in this room right now. In a city of 100,000, 150,000. So when we leave here, what are we supposed to not do? What is at the center of this sin?
The economic system.
Yeah, it's economic system, yeah.
Okay, some people say capitalism nowadays.
Okay, now it's not capitalism then.
No, but...
And that's why on Friday we'll have a separate session on coming out of empire now, and we'll get a chance to discuss, you know, how similar or different is our world from this world? Where is empire now? What does this mean for us? But in their world, this is obviously not capitalism as such.
It's just basic commerce.
It's not all commerce. I want to underscore that. You know, I mentioned this earlier this week in terms of heavenly liturgy. The apocalyptic vision here, this is the Christian vision in general, isn't to say Christians are called not to have fun. You know, that God made all this good stuff and you're not supposed to enjoy it. You know, it's not a Puritan vision here. That's why some people, you folks didn't happen to do it today, but some people will generalize and say the sin is luxury or wealth. That's not it exactly. When we look tomorrow at New Jerusalem, New Jerusalem streets are lined with gold. And the tree, you know, bears fruit all year round. So it's not that God is calling us to denial. Yeah.
I was just thinking that as a Christian in that society, what you would not want to do is try to emulate this empire on an individual basis and glean what you can from it to do your own little empire.
Okay.
Or exploitation, maybe. That's what you wouldn't want to do, is exploit people for your own use.
Okay. I think that's the key word myself here. It summarizes some of this exploitation.
And how do you engage in commerce without exploitation?
That's what New Jerusalem's there for. So tomorrow we'll look at that. Today is kind of what you're not supposed to do. Tomorrow, Revelation provides an image of how life is supposed to be. And it's a glorious image. It's not an image of self-denial. It's an image of coming out of a false system and living in a true system. A system given by God rather than one given by human beings posing as God, as gods. Okay? So now, their mourning, who's celebrating? Who are the celebrants? Specifically named.
Saints, apostles, and prophets.
One more before that, beginning of the verse.
Heaven.
Heaven is supposed to celebrate along with the saints or holy ones, apostles, prophets. Three different ways of speaking of the ecclesia, the Christian community, who resides in heaven in contrast with the kings of the earth. Again, underscoring the point, not those in the sky, not those who are dead, those who live in New Jerusalem, as we'll see. So we look out upon empire, under the image of Babylon, and these people, the sailors, shipfarers, and shipmasters, and seafarers, the merchants, the kings of the earth, mourn. What are they mourning about exactly? Are they mourning for Babylon?
No.
Mourning for themselves.
They lost their jobs.
You know, they don't care about Babylon for their own its own sake. They're saying, all of our market has just burned down, just been destroyed. You know, the source of our wealth and such has just been completely demolished. Okay. So you look out to sea, and these folks, you know, think it's tragedy. And these folks, the saints, apostles, and prophets, say it's a time to celebrate. It's about time. Now, once we start thinking time, we've got to be careful here. Because they've tried to underscore, in the apocalyptic sense, this is not about the future. Especially in Revelation sense. It's something that distinguishes Revelation from some of the other apocalyptic literature that precedes it. In Daniel's time that we looked at briefly last week, Daniel's apocalyptic image, where he was trying to help Israelites in a particular empire, the Seleucid Empire, stay faithful amidst their oppressive situation by believing that the battle that appears to be won by empire on the ground in heaven is being fought by Michael, the prince of your people, Michael the archangel, and is being won by God. So you just need to hang in there and trust that God will win. A future event will happen, and the Seleucid Empire will be destroyed. In John of Patmos' vision, Babylon is fallen already. It's a done deal. It's not a matter of waiting to physically see Rome collapse. You know, in the late first century, the Roman Empire was doing pretty well on this side of the veil. John's vision was trying to teach his audience that from a God's eye perspective, Babylon is not successful. Babylon's already a collapsed ruin. A disaster, smoking shell of its former self. So you don't need to wait for some time in history when that will happen. You need to have the apocalyptic vision that it's already happened. So what are you Christians doing living there? Come out. Celebrate. Be glad. It's already done. And that's why the language of conquest throughout Revelation is, in the Greek grammatical sense, the aorist tense, a tense for completed action. It's done. It doesn't need anything further to have happen. All that has to happen is for Christians to stop being a part of, you know, living in the ruins. That's, in the apocalyptic sense, what faith is. To believe that that's the case. Contrary to what appears to meet the eye. You know, which ought to be no stranger to us, as I mentioned earlier in the week, then looking at Jesus crucified, humiliated, is somehow a victory. It's really not any different than that. An image that we're familiar with, you know, it's at the core of our faith, that what appears to be a humiliating defeat is somehow a victory. Okay? Similarly here, with this imperial reality in which they live, what appears to be victory for empire, the crushing of dissenters and the crushing of people all around the world to take their goods and turn people into slaves, is in fact already a disaster from God's eye perspective. Okay? Now, what would this mean for you? You know, if you believe this is so and you're a Christian in Asia, you know, what do you do? You hear this proclaimed at your worship, and then what's next?
You go home.
Yeah, you go home, and then what do? And is anything different? Or is that, wow, that was a powerful liturgy. Nice retreat we just had. Back to work.
You would probably separate yourself and maybe into small little enclaves of living the simple life.
A simple life? You know, we'll talk specifically about the form of that life tomorrow, New Jerusalem. An abundant life, though. Not an ascetic life. Where does it happen? I mean, what do you make of this command to come out?
Well, you get brave enough to not do, if the emperor says you have to say Caesar is Lord, you get brave enough not to do that.
Okay. So I hear implicit, I just want to be able to name it and see if that's what you're suggesting. You're not hearing this as leave town.
No. Okay. Move where you're planted.
Okay. Now, it's important to see that in the prophetic images that are on the back of your handout, it was literal. They were literally in Babylon, and the call was for the Israelites in Babylon to go home to Israel, you know, to physically get up and go. Now, that's why I just want to make clear that we're hearing this now, not that Christians are supposed to get out of the Roman Empire. Where are they going to go? The Roman Empire is the whole world, but somehow to do something different within it. And we'll see that emphasized tomorrow. New Jerusalem is surrounded by empire. One of the challenging things in Revelation is every time that our sense of closure wants to say, evil's destroyed, you know, death gets thrown in the lake of fire, the text opens it up again. Because it's poetry. You know, it's trying to emphasize in our minds that this is an apocalyptic vision. It's not chronological. You know, contrary to the prophecy readings and some of the other popular readings, it's not describing a sequence of events. It's describing two perspectives on ongoing reality. It's really hard for our sense of chronological history, especially as Americans. You know, Anthony Gwither, my co-author, and I were discussing this. He's Australian. And we were really discussing our different concepts of time. You know, for Americans, you know, reality is in the future. Tomorrow will be better than today. We'll get this fixed. We'll take care of it. It's all about tomorrow. We have a hard time living in the now. For Europe, life is in the past. You know, it's about history. And it's about living in the light of history, whether it's recent history like the Holocaust or, you know, way earlier European history. You know, Kosovo is just the most recent example of how life is about the past. Okay, Americans are pretty much unique among cultures on this planet where life is about the future. We're woefully ignorant about our history and largely think of it as an irrelevant thing. Well, the past is past, can't do anything about it, so let's live toward the glorious future. For the ancients, life was about the present. It's really hard for us to get ourselves into that mindset. It's almost as hard as learning to speak a foreign language. For us, you know, the present is this thin line that divides the grand past from the great future. For the ancients, and especially in the Mediterranean world we're talking about, the present was all of your lifetime and all of the lifetime of anybody who's alive now, old people and young people. The present had this sense of breadth to it. Anything you can remember, you can actually remember, anything you might experience, that's the present. Okay? So that's where some of the language of people expecting Jesus, we think of it as in the future, they're expecting it in the present to happen. But apocalyptically, this is not about something that will happen sometime on this side of the veil. It's about two versions of the present. The imperial version of the present and the divine version of the present. This side of the veil and the other side of the veil. Okay? Just briefly, I want to summarize one other piece of the sin that's here. And for those who were here just yesterday, you know, hopefully this will make some sense. When we looked at the plot yesterday, we saw at the end of the trumpet sequence, at the end of chapter 9, I tried to draw your attention to, but not too much, the set of four sins that were named. You see those at the end of chapter 9? Feel free to turn to those. Anybody got that handy? The things that they did not repent of? 9:21.
Murder, sorcery, fornication.
Murder, sorcery, fornication, and theft. And I hope we'll see how this chapter summarizes all of those. The business about exploitation is both fornication and theft. And interestingly, theft is the one of the four that's not explicitly named in this chapter. You see how the others are. In chapter 18, there in verse 3, says, the kings of the earth committed fornication with her. We see here at the end of the chapter, importantly, that one's at the beginning and one's at the end, that in 1823, all these people, especially the maggots of the earth, etc., were deceived by her sorcery, and the blood of prophets and holy ones and all those who've been slaughtered. So there's murder and sorcery, and we have fornication and theft. This is a description of empire, and one piece of the imperial reality that I want to emphasize, and that's what's so important for us when we consider what it means for us, is this business about sorcery as deceiving, as casting a veil over reality, and claiming that what we see is divine reality, given by the gods in the Roman imperial sense, or just given in the modern sense. The way it is the only way it can be. Leading people, as we saw on Monday in the demonic liturgy, to say, who is like the beast and who can fight against it? You can't fight City Hall. Things can't change. It's so big, we're so small. What's the use? Nothing, you know. So the world's just the way it is. Futile to try and change it and fight against it, which Revelation sees as an implicit form of worshiping empire, granting it authority in your life, feeling powerless in the face of it, feeling that it's not as powerful as God. Okay, but the sorcery piece, again, someone mentioned illicit power. It's the specific power of illusion. One of the other sin lists talks about lying or falsity, those who practice the lie, which is those who repeat the imperial propaganda, who believe it, who spread it, who resent the false reality as if it was ultimate reality. Okay? That's really key. And we'll look, some of us were here last Friday when I used the example of bananas. I'll name that one now just so you can cogitate how that works, and we'll talk about this more on Friday. Obviously everything we eat at Holden doesn't belong here, so we know that. But wherever you live, is somewhere in the United States, what are we doing eating bananas? Don't bananas seem like the most ordinary thing, everyday thing, you know? Everybody loves them, kids like them, they're cheap, they're nutritious, right? What could be bad about a banana, huh?
Lots.
Okay. Some of what, you know, I could spit out for you if you want, you know, the reality of bananas. Some of you already heard it, so I don't want to repeat unless people want it. But part of the illusion here that was facing Christians in the first century was this marketplace was presented to them as if it was normal. All the stuff, cinnamon and spices and scented wood, that wasn't from Roman Asia, appeared in the marketplace and led people to think, what a wonderful thing empire is, huh? We get to buy all this stuff. It's all there. Who'd want to live without it? You know, we're a lot better off now that we've got it all. Whether it's bananas or sport utility vehicles or a thousand other, you know, cheap sneakers made in sweatshops that Jack Nelson Pallmeyer is going to talk about on Friday. It's all presented with a veil. with for our world with advertising and their world with hawking in the marketplace, as if it's just there. As if it grew in your neighborhood or is produced by your friends and neighbors. And of course, that's the lie. That's the sorcery. To trick you, to beguile you into believing that this is the way it's supposed to be. It's not the way it's supposed to be. We have no business eating bananas in North America. Okay? It's just about 10 o'clock, so I know I need to stop. Anybody have any questions? Yeah, feel free.
One question.
Sure.
That very last thing, the very last line in there, and in you was found the blood of the prophets.
Mm-hmm.
It's like going back to the other, under the altar, they're crying out.
Precisely. Yeah, the reference for those not getting that is the fifth seal. Back in chapter 6, those under the altar who have been slaughtered because of their witness cry out, how long? And we shouldn't think of this as limited to Christian martyrs. You know, one of the misunderstandings of Revelation is written in a period of imperial persecution is based on the apparent suggestion in the text that lots of people are dying for the gospel. But I think we should read this, especially under the categories of saints, apostles, and prophets, as all who have died for living God's way throughout all of history because of empire. All have tried to speak the truth that the two witnesses in chapter 11 try and speak and are crushed for it or threatened into silence. Okay? All those, that's the blood of the great city. That's why we can't limit Babylon here to being identical to the Roman Empire. It's not that Babylon equals the Roman Empire. It's that the Roman Empire was the latest incarnation of Babylon. Okay, which leads us to the question we'll talk about Friday. What is Babylon incarnate today?
Yeah.
And what would it mean for us to come out of that?
I guess a question I have, I mean, are we advocating that there be no sharing between different nations or?
We'll get a whole session to talk about that. Tomorrow, if you're going to be here, I invite you to read ahead chapters 21 and 22. That's New Jerusalem. If you have a chance to read that, it'll help inform our conversation. It's a lot lighter than Revelation 18. So if you can read 21, 22, and again, if you didn't get some of these handouts, feel free to take them. If they're helpful, if they're not, don't waste the paper for your own sake or mine. But if there any of these are helpful to you, help yourself. And again, the book sign-up's here if you're interested.